You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.
My guest on The Dan Nichols Show this week is somebody I have not just known but have admired for many years. He is extremely funny. He is annoyingly good looking. He is a musical talent as well as a comedy one. And he just has that effortless ability to make people from across the board in South Africa laugh and laugh very hard indeed. He is one of my favourite comedians, and this show means so much to him that he's even borrowed Becky Gale's hat for the occasion. Datsun Kwanza. So welcome.
You couldn't keep it lovely. You couldn't. You well, actually couldn't.
I think you know me well enough by now.
I was like, this is going swimmingly well. And then you...
Show you one hand, give you the other. Welcome. It is lovely to see you.
Thank you very much, Dan. Very nice to be in your... is this the second... rendition of the Dan Nichols Show?
It is. After becoming a globally iconic superstar on television, with regular fan mail from places like Zambia and Malawi and Botswana, across Africa. No, actually, in fairness, we had a great audience right across Africa.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember we once had a Zambian footballer on the show, and I don't think there was anybody in Zambia who didn't send me a fax afterwards to demand more Zambian celebrities. But the other one wasn't available. We had a great time, and it was a huge amount of fun. And we obviously had you on the show, I think, on a number of occasions. But I think this is the transition, and for those of us who are in that broader entertainment.
Even the
space,
look, by the way, I do see the rugged. What is this? Because I do know, as a person without hair, that people with hair is very much attached to like their story and their life. Like you cut your hair, if something happens, you grow your hair. So what is this?
I think the beard speaks to a kind of a... I feel like it'd be on the cover of a rural edition of Men's Health Canada, kind of lumberjack in training. And then the hair is actually an issue of contention at home. I am one of a number of people. This was Faf du Plessis who got me involved, Alvi Armani, to get the hair transplants done. But my Greek family were very, very upset. My wife is Greek. Because I had them done on my head, they wanted them done on the chest. Because for a Greek, I have very little chest hair. And so the gold jewelry has nothing to nestle upon as your shirt is undone.
It just slides.
Six buttons to the navel. So I think that might be the next one. And maybe just a sprinkling on the shoulders just for a bit of Hellenic authenticity.
I love it. New look, new Dan, new show.
Yes and no. It's an interesting format. I think we started the podcast last year. I don't think anybody had ever done a podcast before. I think we were the first one globally. I invented the format. I think podcasts have become what banana bread was during lockdown. Everybody's got one and is doing one. But it gives me a great deal of pleasure in this format because where with television, you'll remember being on the show, you'd pitch up and you've got a wrestler on one side of you and you've got a magician on the other. And those are the three of you.
You guys did an eclectic spread of three guests each episode too.
And I think it worked really well because we'd get feedback from somebody who I tuned in to watch the show because I thought Victor Matfield would be great because I love rugby. And then I discovered that this Tatsun Konzo guy is really funny. And so people would discover someone they might not otherwise have.
Great.
And it was always fun watching the interaction, particularly I remember we had one show, and this you're now on the Tatsun Konzo show interviewing Dan Nichols. I remember we had Hashim Amla on the show and John Barnes, the Liverpool great. And they walked into the green room beforehand, preparing for the show. And John Barnes is of Caribbean heritage, grew up loving cricket, and was starstruck by seeing Hashim Amla, who in turn, massive football fan, starstruck at seeing John Barnes. And Khan Morby from the Parlatones is standing on his own in the back of the room going, I'm here too, guys, I'm here too.
That's what I love about that. There's very few broadcasters and entertainers who bring cross-genre or cross-industry kind of genre in the arts. So you'll never find, like, let's say, for example, a comedian with, like, a musician in terms of anything. Like, very few comedians work with musicians and very few musicians work with comedians. Like you say, cricketers and footballers, it's like there's no context in which we can come together, which I always love because it's all kind of the same aspiration when it comes to like South African arts and sports.
And you're all just, we're telling stories.
Yeah.
And we have so many of them. And I always loved that was an extreme example of John Barnes and Hashi Mamla. But so often there'd be people who would spend half the show while I'm trying to talk to them and be very entertaining, talking to each other instead.
Hilarious.
Because they're so excited to have met each other or seen each other again. And oh, I remember watching you score that try. I bought your first album when I was at school. Those kind of links, because when you get to tell those unexpected stories, that for me was one of the great rewards. And it reminds me of a story you did tell, and this came up in conversation about a month ago. I was talking to the great Michael Frijon, who is the godfather of wine in South Africa, our greatest wine writer, wine judge, wine authority. He's almost 200 years old, but still goes strong, and he's a great friend of mine. And I was chatting to him about the art of wine tasting, and most specifically of wine spitting, because when you are doing wine tasting, if you actually drink all the wine, you'll be under a table in half an hour. I've done tastings where we've tried 100 wines in a go, and if you don't spit them all out, you're in for a world of trouble.
Right. And if you don't, you can get through it.
Completely. It has absolutely no impact. And what you're doing is the taste and the mouthfeel and the texture, etc., of the wine, the smell of it, the nose. And we're talking about the spitting and how people get that wrong. And I thought, well, you know what? I actually know the Sia Colisi of Bokdrol, because I remember you telling me on the show when you got introduced by some Afrikaans friends or clients. I can't remember the exact context, but this wonderfully South African space of how far can I spit a small animal dropping, and Bokdrol is the name of the game that you'd taken on, and you broke barriers, because this is a traditionally Afrikaans game, and then along comes the Sia Colisi of Bokdrol, Tuts and Konzo, to take on this game and discover you were actually
I'd like to thank all the car guards. I'd like to thank all the nurses, everybody who watches us on the screens in Ellerines and Bradlow's. We love you. Thank you. Couldn't have spat without you. Yeah, no, look, it's my job. Look, comedy is the one thing. Like last week I was at a conference of a big organization that was doing like a huge rebrand that South Africa hasn't seen yet. My job literally takes me in front of different rooms and different people. So the things I know and have no business knowing, to be quite honest, are literally mostly because of the line of work, where my line of work lands me in. I was in Kimberley when I learned about that kind of Afrikaans world. I was in this other, I can't remember the name, but like I'm in AGM meetings, I'm seeing financials, I'm learning so much about this country, like as a fly on the wall as a comedian. And I think that's part of the reason why I kind of really, really still enjoy my job, because you guys just don't stop. you just don't stop. So there's never anything to stop watching and creating. So still enjoying my job after 16 years doing it because of just the dynamic nature of what I do.
And you call it job, and I'm glad you do, because it's often the entertainment space is quite easy to dismiss as, yes, it might be cool and fun, but yeah, you're not sitting behind a desk, you're not working on spreadsheets, you're not doing the kind of things a real job would infer. But it is an enormous amount of hard work, and part of the reason I have steered away from being having a crack, I'd imagine unsuccessfully, at out-and-out comedy.
Oh, yeah?
Partly because I'm obviously far too good-looking and people wouldn't take it seriously.
Too rugged.
But there is so much work that goes into creating these sets, creating things like the one-man shows, something that you have honed and mastered over the better part of two decades now. But roll it all the way back to his young Tuts and Konzo, I'm imagining at school, surrounded by all the it girls, making everybody laugh, very much the cool kid, and wondering what to do with life. Was that the case? Do I have the right vision of the young Tuts?
You know, I can honestly, I was in grade 7, instead of 5, when I can honestly say I discovered my laugh. There was a friend of mine, Kanya Nisha, And him and I, all I remember of that year was in the back of the class making each other laugh, but like hilariously. I couldn't believe every single day I looked forward to go to school just so I could just spend that day with this guy coming up with the silliest things. And that year was literally the year that I think I disappeared into laughter. I was a prefect and I was a very well-behaved kind of role model pupil.
You were a nerd.
A very good nerd. You know what I mean? I used to do my work. I used to get my marks and I was kind of this model kid. And then grade 7, Khanya Nqisha came into my life. And my goodness, Dan, I promise you, the laughter. At some point, I used to get kicked out of class because of the amount of laughing that I couldn't hold in. And I remember Mr. Dell, may his soul rest in peace, he was like the prefect overseer, shouting at me in the passage at school, like he couldn't believe what happened to me. I was watching an adult literally confused at, I remember the words, what happened to you? And I'm just standing there listening to him, knowing that I can't change, because as soon as this is finished, I can't wait to laugh with Khanya again. And I think it from 1998 was when I discovered that I love laughing, and it wasn't even to make others laugh. My thing wasn't for an audience. I only discovered that when I moved up to Joburg, literally 10 years later, to start comedy. My first comedy stint was an audition for a talent show, a comedy talent show. And before that, I'd never done it to make people laugh.
Something parents absolutely dream of is their children revealing to them that instead of going to medical school, they're actually going to try and make it as a stand-up comedian, and the guaranteed riches, success, and prestige that ensue. What was the initial plan? Because I find most comedians have got something they were planning to do, they'd studied for, there was an idea, even if it was maybe more of their parents than theirs. And what was the family response to, actually, this is what I want to try?
I moved up to Joburg to study advertising. My sister was in the advertising space. So I moved up to do marketing, which I studied and finished, and actually worked in agency. I did the agency life. And then when I left comedy, the trick is to not tell your parents.
They still don't know. They think you're in advertising.
When I left advertising, I didn't tell my folks. When I started, because I took a gap year. I was working, and I kind of realized that I was in that that traditional kind of work flow, 9 to 5, you know, get your accolades, get your promotion. So I could feel that I was in the workforce of the country. And to be quite honest with you, I wasn't sure how comfortable I was, because number one, I didn't know if I wanted to do advertising forever, even though I was good at it. So I was kind of like enjoying the benefits of this thing that I was uncertain about. So I took a year off. I got enough money to kind of not have to earn money. And then for that year, I kind of did whatever I want. I entered songwriting competitions. I stayed at home and drew and watched movies and watched live concerts for like a whole year, just literally being this kid in the big city. And then in November of that year was when I discovered the comedy competition, which I took part in. And then I never stopped doing comedy again. And when I didn't tell my parents about that year that I took off. And I didn't tell them once I started stand-up comedy. They saw me on the TV. It was an SABC One show.
You suddenly got 17 missed calls.
100%. They saw me on TV doing like this comedy thing, and they were just proud that I'm just trying this thing. But little did they know.
Look, he looks just like our son,
who should be in the office.
Yeah, I'm sure he's got a meeting.
Yeah. So, yeah, until I started making money from comedy, it kind of just overlapped, and then they kind of knew. But I didn't, like, tell them, Mom, Dad, I'm leaving. Yeah.
Probably the wise way to go. Lie to your parents, children.
No!
That is Uncle Tatsa's advice to our predominantly teenage audience.
And then make sure you work hard and make it happen. Make sure you make hard and make it happen. Yeah, work hard and make it happen.
That very first audition obviously went well.
Yes.
What was it like, though, as this kid who's supposedly going to be in advertising but has got a history of making people laugh and having teachers shout at him as a result, is now actually trying it for real.
You know how you came up with the podcast idea before anybody else?
I did.
I went to that audition for my stand-up comedy. I had a guitar. And the only reason I had a guitar was because I at least knew how to sing and play. I didn't know how to do stand-up, so I thought if I put them together, this would be like the best thing that these judges have ever seen and the world has ever seen. So I went in with that confidence of like, I'm bringing something new. I even remember the song that I performed. It was I wrote a song about the process of standing outside the queue. It was a long queue of character comedians dressed up and people kind of walking in one by one. And it was to the tune of Dirty Diana. Boom, 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 boom. And then I wrote my song. Been standing out in the sun. It's been a long, long day. Been hungry, thirsty, and hot. But no, I won't complain. So David having some Nando's in that long, long break. Nobody told me to pack a scuffy, and I won't complain. And then I carried on. And David Gow was one of...
I still remember that.
Yeah, no, I do, 100%. David Gow was one of the judges, and I just carried on playing. These judges better play ball, and I just threatened them essentially, like they better put me through because we've been waiting out in the sun. It's 30 degrees at Joburg, and when I finished, bah, and it was tell me, are you okay? Tell me, am I okay? Am I okay, David? That's how I ended the audition. Tell me, am I okay? You know, and then eventually they were like, "You're okay," and then from there, I've literally never stopped doing stand up. November 2008.
That's it's an extraordinary start, that wonderful journey. And to have people like David, who many people don't know, is now in his late 70s, as one of the judges. Actually, he and I were at university together, so that doesn't reflect well on me.
So you were in Cape Town with him?
I was in Cape
Town. So you saw the beginning of, because he started doing stand-up in Cape Town as a drama student.
I would never go and watch David Cowell before. I have far better things to do. No, actually, Dave and I have a great story in that he was the entertainment representative of his residence. And I was at that stage, not Dan Nichol, but Dan the Man on UCT Radio.
Come on, Dan!
Afternoon drive show. And as a result of that, I managed to con people, and you have musical ability, I do not. I would DJ at parties, which basically meant putting in a mix CD with the...
Just explain the mix
system,
CD to the listener.
off the tape cassettes, and then pretending to mix non-existent vinyl with headphones on while this played out. And David hired me to play to what was an exclusive audience of young black South African students waiting for an R&B and Kwaito evening, as I had a collection of late 90s, early 2000s soft rock.
Oh, no.
I think I lasted 8 minutes before I got chased out by a very irate gang. And David, on one hand, not happy that things hadn't gone according to plan, but he was far more joyous at just how funny the situation.
Comics usually find great glee in seeing somebody struggling up on stage. We don't want it to go badly, but as soon as we see you are tapping into that sweat equity.
No one embraces Schadenfreude like a comedian. Oh, it's going badly.
Schadenfreude, what is that?
Brilliant. It's the wonderful German word to take pleasure from somebody else's misfortune.
Schadenfreude.
Yeah, the Germans have all sorts of made-up words for all sorts of things.
Schadenfreude, yeah. It's something I can't explain. It's like knowing that you're fine, knowing that you think you're not fine. It's like watching someone think they're drowning on the shallow end of the pool. It seems like it's the worst thing that can be possibly happening to you, but it really isn't. And so as a comedian, I don't know what it is. It's just like also knowing that we'll never be able to see you work like that again and being interested in what the heck you pull out. Like you were probably thinking, which song is next? They're not dancing to my, you know, Roxette. They're not dancing to Bryan
and
Adams.
Who doesn't dance to Roxette and Bryan Adams? Oh, sheesh. Luckily, I'm now at a stage as a middle-aged white man where I understand youth black culture far better. And I often see the admiring looks when I burst onto the dance floor at an event and they nod knowingly as glide effortlessly across the floor.
Galagata will get you doing the weirdest things, I'm telling you.
There is no car crash quite like a comedian dying on stage. It is an important part of the learning process for a comedian.
Yes.
I have been at the helm of a number of events as MC when somebody has gone down in flames. Ooh. And it is a deeply painful, painful experience. And there is not a comedian who has not had it to a degree. And if they say they haven't, I do not believe them.
Yes. To a degree is a good addition.
Yeah, because some will be worse than others. Yes. What was the... And there have been very few, I'd imagine, in your career because you're
only
a master what you do.
To be honest with
you. So what was that one? What was that experience like?
And it was only one because the lesson was learned bigly on a big stage. It was actually the second, it was actually the season premiere of the second season of that reality comedy show that I entered. So I did so well in the first season that they asked me to kind of be a guest live performer in the second season premiere launch event.
So and no pressure, just a
no
nice...
pressure. That's what I thought. I was like, I'm in. They think I'm funny. And I went there. First of all, I was late for the sound check, so I didn't even sound check my guitar to check the sound. I went in there thinking I'm funny, so I'll try new jokes and things, you know, they haven't heard before. Just try and work it out. I got to the event, the sound desk was at the back of the room, so there was no way that they could get the guitar plugged in by the time I got there. I didn't have any jokes really without the guitar. I was very weak, but I went up on stage and tried anyways. I literally remember a room full of celebrities and journalists and photographers who were obviously taking on this event sponsored by Fanta. David Gowers is a judge. It's a big, you know, look at the winners from last season. I remember speaking and then carrying on speaking and then hearing someone speak and then hearing more people speak and then eventually whispers and eventually, like, it wasn't even 2 minutes before the whole room was just chatting. Like it was a networking session at this glitzy event with this kid up on
stage.
That
is the stuff of nightmare.
I'm trying to play guitar. It's not plugged in. Now it's just like this kid trying really hard to get attention. At some point, David came up and tried to help me by like being conversational. He's like, hey, you just got married. You know, how's your wife? Your wife's a doctor. Hey, you're a comedian. Just trying this like weird to me then because I'm just a young, I don't know how to do this riffing thing. And I remember feeling so, so bad. Went home, didn't even stay for the rest of the event. Woke up the next day, obviously to find, you know, when they're writing the write-ups, the blogs. It was the years of the blogs when they write up about everything that happened. And every single write-up had, and there was this guy who shouldn't have been there, blah, 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 blah. And I remember feeling all the feelings. But then at the end of that, like, completely gut-wrenching process, I said to myself, this will never happen again. So from that, I started getting to gigs early for, like, most of my career. Now, you know, I'm proficient and I've gone a bit back. But call times, half an hour before. Sound check, 2 hours before because I use the guitar. So it's usually a bit more technical. And that death, that horrible death probably set me up to be a very, very bright, new opening act comedian in the industry because I was so jacked and I was so professional and I was so good. But it was only because of that freaking gig that happened.
And that takes me back to the comment earlier about this is a real job, this is real work.
Oh.
People see the 30 minutes on stage, they see the Instagram reel. It all looks fun, it looks easy, it looks like it comes naturally. The amount of work that goes into it is similar to any job. The easier you make it look, the more you have done to be able to do so.
And for us, unlike all other jobs, with comedians, the easier we make it look, the more disrespected the art form. It's not like Simone Biles or, you know, an accountant who's easily able to, like, work with your finances and voila. Or Simone Biles. When you see Simone Biles or LeBron James or, you know, when you see Simone do a triple quadruple flip and land with no sweat, you don't go, that's easy. But when you do, when you see a comedian tell a beautiful joke that makes people feel all sorts of things, and then in the end, they're all laughing. You do that enough times, people go, I think I can. You know what? You know what? And then they come up to you and slap you on the shoulder and, you know, spill their drinks on you. And all of a sudden, that feeling of familiarity quickly creeps in. And that's also one of the things that I pride myself in trying to teach South African audiences. And I appreciate you mentioning that it is a job, because I don't think that at the best, like when we are at our best, that's when people forget that what we're doing is actually very dangerous.
Two things. Firstly, I have heard Simone Biles' comedy and she's terrible. She's really, really dreadful. Secondly, I remember getting an email when we were still running the show on television from a guy who I presume from the tone of voice and the nature of that was reasonably young at his place of work.
Right.
It was his boss's 50th birthday coming up. His boss was a big fan of the Dan Nichols Show. He was also, he's actually really funny and he knows everything about sport. And so as a 50th gift, they wanted him to be one of the guests on the show. So which of these 2 weeks would work better? And I mean, there was a
delight. Can you just talk to my boss?
There was a charming naivety to it.
Right.
But also that assumption that the guy who tells those great stories around the braai after a couple of drinks can be the same as the person who walks up on stage in front of 800 people and not only doesn't freeze, but 20 minutes later has them all going, oh my God, this has been one of the great nights of my life.
Correct.
And that's something that, as you say, the better the work is done on stage, the more other people think, I think I could nail that. I think Cousin Ronald could do this.
Yeah.
He was really funny on Boxing Day last year after Christmas. After
he must tell these
three
complete
bottles
strangers
of Chardonnay.
Yeah. Who have no residence or care, by the way, for anything that you have to say until you make them. It's that. It's a very I guess the high stakes of the hidden high stakes. I don't know how much is evident, but that's what attracted me to it. You know, the creative challenge of like a mic, people, and nothing else but what you decide.
And when you do stand up in front of that, there is a thrill to it. And the scale of the occasion, the nature of the audience obviously plays a role. We've had the low part of you bombing spectacularly on television. And that's obviously the major reel that we're going to cut.
I've actually got the audition on YouTube of my first audition. So if you have space for an insert, I posted it. That many years ago.
You can still see the crackle of the VHS as it comes across the screen. So that was the low point. There have been many high points. I've been lucky to have been in an audience numerous times where you've waltzed on stage, often in a burgundy velvet blazer, and just absolutely taken the place to pieces. What are a couple that you remember?
Man.
Perhaps, if I can ask for two, one where just the sense of the occasion, I can't believe I'm actually hosting this, speaking of this, doing comedy of this.
Right.
And then the one that you look back at that maybe it wasn't quite as big or as famous, but there was just a real fond recollection for that was Tats absolutely killing it.
Yeah, that's an interesting one because I've had to get my wins. Well, let me put it this way. As a comedian, every time a joke works is an absolutely irreplaceable thrill. So if we're talking about the second one where it's like, oh, this is me at my absolute pristine, that can be at a little club with 30 people and me trying a thought that just works. That happened actually last month with a joke of mine. So that happens all the time as I'm creating. But in terms of the occasion that fits, I mean, I've had a few of those. I think I remember the first time I was overseas and like heard one of my jokes work was probably a good one. I was in Edinburgh in Scotland for a month.
Was that at the Fringe?
At the Fringe, yeah. And what an experience, man. I was taken up there by a very, very famous comedy producer stroke manager named Mick Perrin. He actually did Trevor's first tour. He was Trevor's tour manager when Trevor went to Edinburgh and kind of broke out into the world. Because Trevor, when he first did the Edinburgh, everyone was just like, who is this kid and what is this show? And it was Daywalker times. So his material was very like, yo, what? We've never seen this before from the third world. And Mick Perrin kind of picked him up from there. And then after Trevor, he started this international comedian agency. And I was one of the people he picked up in that rollout of that, me and a couple of other comics from around the world. Now he's representing Skalkbus Aidenhout, who's with him. Loiso Gola was with him. I think in terms of South Africans, those are the two. But just being in that space, being in that conversation was kind of like very validating for me in terms of the work I'm putting in Four Ways and Sandton and Randburg and Soweto and Tanzania and Eastern Cape in terms of like the craft actually translates.
How important was that validation? Did you need it more than you realized?
You know what? I think what I needed was just a location of where I'm at. More than validation, I think it was just a very clear picture of in the world of comedy, this is where I am. Because I think what we forget as South Africans, when you enter the world of being an artist, it's not just being a South African artist. Like if you decide today you want to be a painter, you're not just, you are in the world of every painter who's ever existed. If you allow yourself to be in that, really be in that space. So if you're writing a song, you are entering the world of music. And it's very easy to not think like that because you're in little old South Africa. To not think that your writing and your skill isn't as wanted and needed because you're here. So when I kind of got signed by Mick Perrin, that was kind of a, hey, what you're doing is of world standard. So that kind of communicated that. And then when I went to Edinburgh, and kind of saw other acts and saw other shows and went to the parties and kind of also saw the business side of it and the social side of it, I also got to see in terms of, oh, this is where I'm at, the work I need to do, the work I don't need to do, the stuff I want to pursue, the stuff I don't want to pursue. And it just brought everything into perspective. So when I came home, I started enjoying my work so much more because I just knew that I knew that I knew so much more. And in terms of writing, in terms of chances I take or don't take, you know, because sometimes people see you do something in South Africa and they're like, oh, carry on, you know, they just want this ever expanding thing without the context of like size and timing and longevity and recovery and, you know, disappearing even.
And this is where I blame Trevor Noah, who, look, he and I are not on speaking terms.
Ever.
keeps changing his number. He's done extraordinarily well and deserving of every bit of it,
yeah.
Even if David Kubelka wrote all his material.
Unbelievable.
Shout out David in New York. but Trevor set this benchmark that is just so extraordinarily high. And on one hand, it gives our South African talent a look at a pathway, a look at what's possible. Yeah. But then there's also that degree to which, well, it is amazing to be able to go over and host The Daily Show in America. And he did an extraordinary job of it.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody else could have followed on from Jon Stewart. And what he did was exceptional.
Mm,
but
100%.
That's not what everybody has to do. And I think getting a sense of, okay, as a creative force, where do I want to go? How far do I have to push it? Do I need to do all of these things? What is giving me, as well as a decent living, the most reward? What is making me most fulfilled? And for somebody, it might be, if you have the opportunity, going to do The Daily Show in America. But for somebody else, it might be staying in South Africa. Yeah. I love the country. I love working the circuits. That's what means the most to me. And I think for many creatives, identifying what that horizon actually is, what nirvana really means, as opposed to what other people might think it means, is one of the challenges once you've reached a certain level of success.
100%. And if you don't pay attention to everything that you've just asked, literally, you stay in limbo for your whole career because you never know. You will achieve the biggest and largest and most recognized anything, but because you don't have a win in your head, then you never achieve it. I was in Mhlanga last month doing a show, and it was during the day, like on a Wednesday, and I had a lovely young lady with me who's also an artist who had a gig later that day. She plays classical music. And we were both just sitting there like in the sun as these artists in Mhlanga on a Wednesday in South Africa. And just, she made me realize that this is it. Like the fact that we were able to do that, translate us and put us in Los Angeles, translate us and put us in Nelspruit or Gaborone or Czechoslovakia, like we're doing it. And if we don't understand that's what we're doing just because we're in South Africa, then you lose those moments of like you are an artist, active and earning, and that is the goal of this whole thing. And so if you don't have that conversation, I mean, I realized in particularly with me, I was pursuing overseas until I got to the point of understanding where I was. And to be quite honest with you, for the past couple of years, my interest has been to grow material and speak to South Africans, especially after 2020, when I realized, look, everyone's got their spokesman and everyone needs their artists to rise up and start speaking to their people and kind of doing that work of being an artist in terms of rebuilding. And from 2020, my focus, you know, shifted from the world, because what am I going to go to America and say when they're in need, like when they are in need of help?
Especially in your Kamala Harris t-shirt.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And so now I'm like very confident in terms of my work, very confident in terms of like my excitement to talk to South Africans, because I actually have stuff to say. And maybe that will shift again and then I'll shift my focus. But that is what I have to keep in touch with. I mean, I remember when I was not happy in Joburg, and it was death for me because I was like, I can't be an artist living in a place uninspired. And you've just always got to keep that love for the thing, because otherwise just go be an accountant and make more money, man, if you're going to do this and still be miserable. I think we chose this because it's a fun, joyful thing that can earn us a living. And when we do earn a living from it, we've got to make sure that we keep doing whatever it is to keep that fun and that joy. Otherwise, again, I say, go and study something that makes you more money and be miserable and have greater holidays.
Just go and be a rhythmic gymnast and
you know what
be
I mean?
The next Simone Biles.
A yoga instructor or something.
Keeping that joy is a real challenge, keeping that spark. Part of it, I think, is the variety that this sort of platform affords you.
Yes.
And I've seen a few things of you of late. Did I see you down in Durban being very rude to people? I think there's that comedian who's named after the inexpensive brandy.
Richelieu.
That would be the one.
Richelieu Benoit.
Richelieu Benoit.
Yes.
Of course, I know well. I had him on the show a couple of times. He's a very funny man.
Yes.
And yes, what were you guys up to there?
Richelieu Benoit is Comedy Central's roast battle champion. And roasting is basically what South Africans call tugwara, or in the Eastern Cape, we call it unlita, which is making fun of each other. And so Richelieu and I are trying to conceptualize a comedy show that incorporates that element of teasing and gwaraing, but from an audience perspective. So you know, roasting has now become this thing in comedy, but it comes from a very American culture. Even the way they do it is very American. And in South Africa, you know, you go to every suburb, every township, or rather, let me start every township, because that's where the outside loitering culture exists, where people are just sitting and then all of a sudden going at each other. So we're trying to make a comedy show that can have that kind of community involvement. There's banter between audience and comedian. We've got like these mechanisms of cards and yellow cards where an audience member can, if someone's talking, raise their card, and it's almost like this interactive comedy thing that we're trying to make. It was beautiful. Durban was our first one, and the format is still conceptualized, but we definitely, it's something that we want to introduce to the country and hopefully have like people coming out on stage, people who not necessarily are locked in as stand-up comedians, but just people who do this thing just with lights and cameras and getting some money, hopefully.
So I understand this. This is your way of asking me to come and join your show and be part of it. Look, I realize it's a shameless play on the youth demographic who I speak to so directly and so fervently. I'm not somebody who normally likes casting aspersions or making insulting comments about people
You've got some fire in you. You've definitely got some poison, deadly snipey poison.
I'm gonna come along to one of these, but I'm gonna come in a raincoat and sunglasses and a moustache. You won't know it's me, and then I shall dazzle the stage.
That'll make you more of a target or less of a target.
Well, I've been told the court order said I'm not allowed to wear those raincoats anymore, right. And certain schools. I'd love to come along. That sounds like a lot of fun, just to watch and see you guys play out. It sounds like
absolutely
cool platform.
I think what excites me is because the energy and spirit of it just on a street level is so already there. I think once we kind of figure out how to get it on stage, because to be quite honest with you, right now roasting and guaring and unlita belongs to comedians in terms of how it's presented into South Africans, but comedians aren't, stand-up comedy isn't that. There are people who do that, and they are your everyday, you know, Jane and Jabu, and we need to get them in front of camera so that South African expression and authenticity can come out. I don't even know what it will look like, but I know it's very, very colourful.
Well, I had dinner with Jane and Jabu last week, so I will speak to them.
Are they still together?
They are, surprisingly, amazing. Despite everything. All right, so we've got that. And then November. Now, November is an important month in the Nickel household because it is my wedding anniversary. Normally, it's a day that my wife spends at home with the curtains shut, just weeping and wondering why she made this decision and how she can possibly get out of it.
So this guy's looking healthier by the day.
So I was looking for something interesting to do. You've got some comedy coming up.
My new show... called Cancel the Gain, is going to be doing a residency at a very, very beautiful theater stroke cinema in Parkhurst called Egrek. Every single Saturday in the month of November, I will be there from 7 until 9 o'clock with very special guests.
So it's a breakfast show.
In the evening.
The thought of a comedian being awake before lunchtime.
Look, I'm going to save that as an idea for something in the future, but I love my genre and I think it fits anywhere and everywhere. But for this show, every single Saturday of November, I'm going to be doing my show. It's at Parkhurst. Tickets are available at howler.co.za. For the first one, I've got very, very, very... excellent and one of the highest, what I regard as highest artists in this country. He's an MC stroke rapper. His name is Stogie T, formerly known as Dumi, formerly from Dumi and the Volume.
So when you say he's the highest artist, are we expecting
in terms of craft,
talking to unicorns,
in terms
running
of craft.
Past him with a severe case of the munchies and a desire to one day move to Amsterdam?
No, he's a craftsman. And it's like what I was saying to you, trying to create platforms where different artists from genres come together. So I'm a comedian, and with this residency, I'm also going to be inviting my special guests who are not all going to be comedians. So for example, this one is a rapper, stroke MC, stroke poet. And he's going to be coming to just share, to give us his story, show us some of his work, and it's going to be a good time of laughs and artistry. So if you are around and listening to the show, please book your ticket, howler.co.za, every Saturday, Parkhurst at a Greek Cinema Stroke Theatre. Very, very, very looking forward to it, because this new show is also, it's also what I'm excited about.
Like, and I love the fact that as you say this, your eyes are lighting up. There is a big smile.
Yes.
You've been doing this now for 16 years.
Yes.
Unless, of course, you're listening to Mr. and Mrs. Nkonzo, in which case he's been doing it for 3 years, part-time, while still running his very successful advertising agency that we just can't remember the name of.
Thank you.
But you're still filled with delight. This is still exciting you. Mm. And that makes me so happy to see.
No, and it's been with effort. I think very early on, I was very conscious of what being good at this kind of work, where it can take you. And one of the many places it can take you is away from the love of it. So you can get good at stand-up, and then stand-up opens up avenues for adverts and opens up avenues for movies and opens up avenues for hosting corporate MC gigs and avenues for writing in writing rooms. And all these things are amazing and fantastic, but they do take you away from that minute or that second of thinking about your new and next joke. And like I said to you, there's nothing that replaces just going up on stage and doing a joke that you thought of and it works. And so you have to be very intentional about your no's and your yeses as your career is going. And for me, one of my main goals, my main goal in stand-up comedy, I've always said, is to be enjoying it 20 years from now. And that takes work. It takes waiting. It takes saying no to something that is right there because other people see it in you. I remember when I started, people were wanting me to like do one-man shows when all I had was 15 minutes of very good material. But people will just see that and then put more on you when you're not even ready as a young artist. So if you are not aware of like, yeah. No, thank you for that deal to sign me, but I literally don't have the ability to carry on with all these things that are being offered. So what I did very early on was kind of grow very organically and very intentionally in my craft. And as you do that, you then grow and people invite you and you become an open act and then a support act and then a headliner and then a corporate guy and then a host of SA's Got Talent. But it all happens as you kind of take your time to grow strong in the thing, because you can absolutely get everything on day two. You can. But it's not the smart way, and it's not the way to do it if you want to like be an artist in this country for the rest of your life, like a cashier or a mechanic. You know, it's not a big country. It's not many opportunities that are being created in terms of like being able to do this and then this and then this and then that and then this. It's not like that here. So you do have to be calculating in terms of your movements and your coming up and going out. Every artist does it, you know what I mean? Like, we haven't seen, an album from, or a movie from, or a book from, or a painting from, because it's ebbs and flows. And you've got to do that in this country. You've got to make way for that to be able to really like enjoy being a South African artist, man.
It's a very wise philosophy. Ugh. It's one that you've grasped a lot earlier than many have in the broader industry. Yeah. And I think the long-term gain has been considerable.
Yeah, and 100%.
It shows. And you have already an extraordinary body of work to look back on and many great adventures and only one absolute disaster, which we'll be replaying as often as we can on the show. But I think what's just as exciting is that there is still so much more of Tuts and Nkonzo to come. And I think you'll know where some of that is headed, but some of it will take you by surprise, and happily so.
Yeah.
And those of us who are watching amongst your very large fan club will be delighted as it plays out.
Yeah, and thank you. And thank you to – it's very difficult for me to say I have fans or supporters because
– Well, you don't. I made that part up.
Yeah. But,
you've just got two parents who are trying to work out, where why does he keep talking about this comedy thing?
But I am very, very happy to still be enjoying it. And I know that I haven't applied myself in terms of like the expansion part of my comedy, like I say, it's just been the work and the actual jokes. So in terms of like becoming this force.
This brand,
which is also work to do. I do look forward to doing that, you know, in time to come. But I'm just so happy that my craft has kept me up to this point and very excited that with the addition of that kind of work, I mean, you know, space is the limit. Forget the sky.
We shall be watching closely. And in the spirit of your new Guara Guara show with Richelieu, I shall sign off by just thanking you very much for filling in on such short notice from poor Pops, who wasn't able to make it.
That's... I cannot believe you. We miss you, Nolene. Come back.
Joining me on the show this week, Becky Gnella, we promise you can get your hat back soon. He is one of South Africa's most exciting young comedians. His parents named him after Tatiana Schoenmaker, and he's flourished since. He is the ad exec who, armed with a guitar and a sense of humor, rocked up an audition, and 16 years later, I can safely say, he's one of South Africa's greatest comedy talents. Joining me on the show this week, Tats and Konza.
You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.